Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Coming up on episode 276 of Wheel Bearings, we've got the Toyota RAV4 Adventure, the McLaren Artura. I tried out Tesla's full self-driving beta. GM's working with its dealers to put EV chargers in communities. Apple's delayed its car. IHS is trying to determine if its crash test facilities can handle heavy EVs. And Polestar and Mercedes are offering EV powertrain upgrades. All that and more coming up next. Episode 276 of Wheel Bearings. I'm Sam Abul-Samad from Guidehouse Insights.
And I'm Roberto Baldwin from, let's say, Motor One this week.
And Nicole is still on vacation with her hubby in Europe. They're landing back in Boston, I think, late tomorrow night. And then she'll be home for a day and then off on another drive trip. And so next weekend, we'll all be back together.
Next weekend, it'll be exciting. It'll no longer just be the Sam and Robbie show.
All right, Robbie, you had some interesting stuff to drive this week. What did you drive?
I did. If you were listening to last week's episode, I just right in the middle, I just left.
Yeah.
So I left in order to go drive the McLaren Artura. This is McLaren's plug-in hybrid supercar. Now, they had hybrids before. They had the Speedtail, they had the P1, but those were McLaren, like, we're going to make three, and they're $70 billion. This is something that regular McLaren owners could buy, if you're a regular McLaren owner.
So, as McLaren owners go.
McLaren owners go, yeah. The starting price is $200.
You and I could not afford one.
No, I could not afford this vehicle. $233,000, so let's just throw that out there. Just put it right out there up front. Driving it, no, it's, it has a 7.5 kilowatt hour battery pack, so it's not a huge battery pack, and it gets, the EPA says 11 miles, McLaren says if you baby it, you're driving around town, you probably get 15 miles, that's your EV only range. So it's not as nice to say a RAV4. A RAV4 Prime.
Which'll do about 40 miles.
But it's also way more fun to drive than a RAV4 Prime. I mean, it's still a McLaren, so they still are trying to keep it light. They're trying to keep it nimble. They're trying to keep it quick. And with this hybrid powertrain, they've been able to do that. The car is about 3,000 pounds. It's not very big, for a hybrid. A plug-in hybrid, 3,000 pounds is pretty much nothing. It has 671 horsepower, 530 pound-feet of torque. It has that EV low-end torque. So you can do 0 to 60 launches in 3 seconds, which at this point you're only seeing that number really when it comes to EVs. So you get that like low-end EV, and then the rest of the motor catches up. So you get that weird feeling when you take off in an EV where it, like, pushes your eyeballs, it squishes your eyeballs, it, like, reforms your internal organs, it pushes... You get that from the McLaren while you're driving it around. Plus, it's really... it's just really fun to drive. It's planted, the battery pack obviously lowers its center of gravity, but they have this twin-turbo V6 in there, and the cylinder is at 120 degrees, so they're really low. It's almost like a boxer engine. They're pretty low, and so that also lowers the center of gravity. So you have this car that's both elements are keeping it pretty low to the ground. So you have this car is sort of stuck to the road, and I drove it in the desert around Las Vegas, and it was very fun and nice long sweeping turns, and I was like, oh, I wish there was something tighter. And then they took us to the Las Vegas Motor Speedway, and they let us drive it on a track where there was a very, very busy circuit, lots and lots of tight turns, and the thing just sticks to the road. It's really, It's kind of crazy. Just, you know, I mean, not it's a McLaren. I mean, they're race car people who decided to start making cars for regular-ish people about 11 years ago. So, you know, they have that lineage. In order to do all this, instead of just cramming, you know, an EV battery, you know, a battery pack into a regular McLaren, they created a brand new architecture. It's called the McLaren Carbon Lightweight Architecture. It's, you know, they have that carbon fiber tub that they're famous for, and they set it up so that it has space for a battery, and then they have, you know, new front and back section that's lighter, it's tighter. The carbon fiber is stiffer, it's lighter than previous carbon fibers that they use in their vehicles, and it does all that, but it's also like super safe, that tub. There was a drive program a couple years ago where one of the journalists, he was with somebody who was new, which is, you know, something that's always terrifying to, like, automotive journalists, is getting a drive partner who's new. You've never met him before. They're young, typically a dude. For some reason, they feel like they have something to prove. And this kid should not probably have been driving a McLaren because he launched it off the road at 70 miles an hour. And it tumbled, and they got, you know, they're, you know, it's the LA mountains. The mountains above Southern California, and, you know, they're upside down. There's
steep drop-offs there.
Yeah, there's some steep drop-offs, and the tub essentially protected them from, like, getting, well, all smashed to hell. So, yeah, so they're taking that, you know, they take that technology for their race car teams, and they throw it in vehicles for regular, well, again, regular-ish people who have a lot more money than you and I. It handles super tight. They don't have steering by wire. They're still using hydraulic assisted steering, which is awesome. If you are a performance enthusiast, drive by wire is still, it's mostly there. I think it's gotten much better. It used to feel like, if you ever drove the i8, mm-hmm. It felt like you were just playing a video game, like the steering. There's no feedback. You're just like, wee, turn left, you go left, turn right, you go right. You don't have any feedback from the road or from the tension of, you know, how fast you're going versus, you know, battling physics. So they're still using hydraulic assisted steering, which is nice. It is the first McLaren with adaptive cruise control. So you got that going for you. If you're the person who buys and dailies your McLaren, and or you're going on a road trip, you have adaptive cruise control. It has lane keep assist, which is essentially just yelling at you when you're leaving your lane, but it doesn't engage the steering wheel at all.
So no active assist, just lane departure warning.
Yeah. So the assistance is just someone yelling at you. You know, it's like a supervisor. They're not doing anything. They're just sort of yelling at you you're doing it wrong. they have a infotainment system. McLaren's not known for its infotainment system. You should not be excited about the infotainment system, outside of the fact that it's an 8-inch touchscreen and it supports CarPlay and Android Auto. That's what you should be excited about. You can adjust a bunch of things in the system. But once you've got it all set up, your car, you just plug in your phone and you'll be a lot happier. While they're building it, one of the things they wanted to do is make sure that it could do 40 minutes of performance driving without losing any EV performance, any electric performance. So they worked on that. That all said, $233,000 is really expensive. It's actually quite, you have electric comfort, sport and track mode. It's actually quite comfortable in comfort mode, which for a McLaren, if you've driven a 720, the GT is pretty comfortable. Is a pretty comfortable vehicle. That's what they built it for. This is like just a little bit below that on the comfort level. So you're going to get a nice, comfortable McLaren when you want it. So you got that going for you. And when you start it up, it always starts in electric mode, so you don't annoy your neighbors. So good for that. And it'll stay in electric mode till the battery's dead or up to 81 miles an hour. And yeah, Zem, McLaren Artura. I'm a big fan. I had a lot of fun driving it. No one got any tickets while we were driving, so that's always good whenever you're driving McLaren. It surprisingly comfortable for a supercar, surprisingly light and nimble for a plug-in hybrid, And yeah, no, I mean, they could have really kind of said, well, we're making a clear and making a hybrid and didn't, like, done a good job and made it work, but they've done a great job. Like, you don't even know, you don't even feel the battery pack. That's a big sign. That's a big thing, is throwing.
Well, you know, I think,
it's not,
you know, keeping
it's not
it,
huge, but, yeah, it, you know.
Keeping it relatively modest at about 7.5 kilowatt hours, you know, I'm sure helps. You know, obviously, you know, if you put in like a, you know, an 18, you know, or 20 kilowatt hour battery, like you might have in some other plug-in hybrids, you know, then you would definitely start to feel it. Plus, you know, it's a fairly small car, and packaging a battery that size in there along with an engine and everything would probably be challenging.
It was really small. It's that's one of the things, like, the wheelbase is pretty short. But yeah, everything, it's just such a fun car. I mean, if you're rich, obviously, I mean, I it's a fun car that I'll drive on drive programs. And, you know, I'm not going up. I haven't won the lottery. I'm not a. I don't have a.
You mean Motor One doesn't pay freelancers quite that much?
No. Who'd I do this for? Oh, it was on for Engadget. So I drove. Oh. So if you want to see, there's a video of me driving it around on Engadget. Yeah. No. It was. It's. It, oh, it has a drift mode, so you can, like, adjust drift up to, I think, 15. 0 to 15 like levels of drift. So you got that going for you on a track. So. Even when they were handing out the cars, they're like, do not use drift mode on the roads. Please do not, you know, do not turn off the traction control on regular roads. We will be on the track later. You can do it there. So
McLaren has, you know, typically has over the last decade had kind of like three different series of cars. They've had, I think it's the Sport Series is the lower end ones, the mainstream
supercar,
and then I forget what they call, like, the mid series, which is cars like the 720S.
Yeah, they just called them the supercars, essentially. Okay. I'm sure they showed me. I think they showed me a slide, but it's supercars is what it is.
And then they've had the limited production top end models, like the P1 and the
Speedtail
and the Speedtail, those, you know, and the Senna, you know, those that they make in runs of like 106 units, I think, because 106 is the number of the original McLaren F1s that they built back in the 90s. And so they did the same number for the Speedtail and the P1. So this replaces like the 650, 670 models in that entry level series.
No, this is a supercar.
Oh, so this isn't that mid range?
Yeah, no, this is definitely it's a far more performance orientated than, say, like the GT. I think the GTs. This is definitely it is quick, it is nimble, it is not when we were on the track, we had to switch cars during a drive, and I got a car with cold tires. Mm-hmm. And they're like, "Hey, you know, we're going on track, be careful." And, you know, the third turn is like, got it sideways.
Yeah,
because it's a supercar. It's got a lot of power. It's got cold tires. It's got, you know, and this is the thing that people don't, you know, people who end up like wrecking their cars at Car and Coffee is that their car's been sitting this whole time, and then they're going to drive away and they don't realize, like, there's so many things make your car like dangerous besides like just a bad stupid attitude and bad ideas. But like cold tires will throw you sideways really quickly when you have a lot of power. And, you know, this is, you know, it's got a lot of power, but it handles really well. And it's definitely a supercar. They are definitely going after, you know, the rest of the supercar lineup, and everyone else is coming out with their hybrid supercars eventually.
Okay. It's interesting, you know, that they've opted for that wide angle 120 degree V6, which is the same configuration that Ferrari's using on the new 296. That's also a 120 degree V6 with the turbos mounted in the V above the engine, so it keeps it relatively narrow.
Yeah, they have the same thing. They have that hot V, and then below the cylinders are the intake mount, the intakes. So the intakes are right below the cylinder, so they get those. Oh, I forgot to say that the instead of using stamping, which they did, they used aluminum stamping. They also essentially use aluminum vacuum forming. In order to get the doors,
for the body?
Like, for the body. And then, so the panels on the door and the panel, the giant panel on the back of the car is actually vacuum formed aluminum. And so you can get these really nice, like pretty, like far more intricate designs using vacuum forming. So if you look at that door, it's super tight. It's got like a really, you know, it's yeah, they don't, you know, McLaren's run by just a bunch of engineers. It's just a bunch of race car nerds. And whenever you get in one, you know, they're, you're going to notice it. It's definitely like the number one thing is making sure the car drives really well. And then there's like everything else, but everything is for that. That's why whenever you get in, you're like, oh, it's got an infotainment system. Sure.
Yeah.
Because that is definitely not, you know,
one of those things that customers expect, but you know, they're not necessarily going to use in a car like this.
Yeah, you're not going to see like MBUX level infotainment system.
No hyperscreens.
No hyperscreen. It's 8 inches. It's essentially looks like a little. It looks like somebody just slapped an Android tablet onto the middle of the dash. The dash cluster though is super nice. It's really bright. It's got a high contrast. It's got like. No, it's super crisp. It's like one of the nicest dash clusters out there, and it's mounted directly to the steering column. So no matter where you put the steering wheel, you can see everything.
Like the Porsche 928s.
Yeah. So I'm a big fan of those just because I'm tall. So sometimes, if I have the wheel down, I can't see the top of the steering wheel. And you know, for cars that have in-car monitoring, some of them have in-car monitoring in the dash cluster at the very top. So suddenly the car's like, "Hey, you need to move your steering wheel." And I'm like, yeah. "Oh, geez."
All right, cool. McLaren Artura. We'll definitely be putting in an order for one of those, I think.
Yeah, well, you know what? We'll get Nicole. Well, I'll put our money in, and we'll spend, like, we'll each get it for a month.
Yeah, we'll just rotate it around. Between the three of us, we should be able to swing it, I think.
Yeah.
All right. I had something that was not quite as energetic, say, as the Artura. I had the Toyota RAV4 Adventure all-wheel drive.
But it's got an adventure in the name.
Yeah, it does. And it's a RAV4, which, you know, for the past several years, since, you know, ever since crossovers moved beyond midsize sedans as the most popular segment in the U.S. market besides trucks, the RAV4 has been the top-selling vehicle for Toyota in North America. And they, prior to the pandemic and then the supply chain shortage last year and this year, they were selling over 400,000 RAV4s a year, including more than a quarter of those being hybrids. The hybrid RAV4 is actually the best-selling Toyota hybrid now. The Adventure that I drove was not a hybrid.
Sorry.
It had just the base 2.5-liter four-cylinder, 203 horsepower, 8-speed automatic transmission. So good there. No CVT in this one. Had a nice 8-speed, which is definitely better. It has dynamic torque vectoring all-wheel drive, which is part of the Adventure package, which. Uses the brakes to send the torque around, hopefully where it'll do the most good to whichever wheels where it's most needed. You know, it's not exciting, but you know, if you need solid transportation for, you know, four or five people, that will probably run for, you know, a million miles as long as you do your regular oil changes and tire rotations and stuff. You know, this is good. You know, it's pretty basic. You know, it does have adaptive cruise control and lane centering assist, blind spot monitoring. The one that I had an option package on there that includes that bumps the 7-inch center touchscreen to a 9-inch touchscreen.
Oh snap!
Got more screen than the McLaren does for a fraction of the price. You get a whole extra inch of screen for, you know, and you save a ton of money getting it. So if you want, you know, more screen than you get in a McLaren Artura, the RAV4 is for you.
Yeah.
you know, it's the engine, the powertrain is, especially, you know, in the non-hybrid, is, you know, it's fine. It's not particularly refined. You know, it can be a little noisy sometimes. It's smooth enough. It just, you know, makes noises that, you know, aren't necessarily enticing or pleasant. it's not, you know, I've been in worse, you know, but it's...
I've been in worse, which is everyone...
It's fine. But the vehicle itself is solid. The ride quality is good. It's comfortable. You know, it handles Michigan pavement, you know, such as it is, with relative ease. You know, it's got all the features that you want, you know, in a modern, you know, standard vehicle. It's got cameras all around. It's got something, it lists here on the Monroney, $269 for a drop ship indicator, whatever that means. That's part of this other package with the two-tone roof. So this was a pale green with a black roof, and a drop ship indicator is included in that, and I don't know what that means.
I'm going to look that up while you're talking.
It's not like they're, you know, picking this up from, you know, factory in China and drop shipping it to you, so I'm not really sure what that's referring to. It does have roof racks, roof rails. So you can, you know, tie stuff to the roof for a road trip and, you know, really add lots of extra drag and reduce your fuel economy. And the fuel economy, you know, it's rated at 28 miles per gallon combined, EPA rated. So 25 city, 33 highway. I did quite a bit of highway driving with it. And wasn't beating this thing up. And it only averaged about 26, which was not that impressive. You know, I think if I was buying a RAV4, I would probably be inclined to get a hybrid rather than this. The adventure package.
Just get the Prime.
Yeah.
It up. If you're going to do it, just go for it, man.
Especially for the price of this one. You know, grand total on this one came to $39,356, which, you know, seems kind of high for what you're getting here. You know, it doesn't feel particularly premium like a $40,000 car should. You know, the base price on the Adventure is $33,700. And you know, it's not like it, you know, the Adventure, you know, it's got black alloy wheels, and those roof rails, you know, so it looks slightly more adventurous, but you know, doesn't really have the functionality. You know, it's not going to compete with something like a Bronco Sport and its off-road capability. So, you know, I would probably go with a different trim level, like, you know, like a hybrid XLE or a hybrid LE, or the Prime. You know, the Prime is, just over 40 grand, I think.
Yeah. 41,590.
Yeah. So, you know, for that kind of money, you know, if you're going to spend nearly 40 grand anyway, get the Prime, get that 40 miles of electric driving range. And I think you'll be a lot happier with this because, you know, most of the time, the vast majority of the driving you're doing, the engine's not going to be running anyway. And so you're not going to hear the kind of, you know, coarse tone of the engine. You'll get a lot better efficiency and, you know, your operating costs will be a lot lower as long as you plug it in every night. The RAV4 Prime or the RAV4 Adventure, almost 40 grand. You want to take a guess at the delivery charge?
Oh, $1,300.
$1,215.
Oh, I'm pretty close.
And, you know, this one was built in
Ontario. I feel like Woodstock, I still win because I'm the only one here.
this one's built in Canada. They also build RAV4s, I think, in Indiana as well. And then the Primes come from Japan. It's a solid, you know, compact crossover, you know, competes against the likes of the CRV and the Escape and the Hyundai Tucson. But like I said, I don't think I would opt for this particular configuration.
Yeah, I tell people to get the Prime all the time. They're like, well, I need to do it. I'm like, just get the Prime. Because they want an SUV. Everyone wants an SUV. They want, you know, in value-wise, you know, CR-V, RAV4. I'm like, just get one of those, get a hybrid of one of those. You're going to be fine. You're going to be a happy camper.
Yeah, and, you know, when I've had the hybrid Tucson or the hybrid RAV4s, I've always gotten around 40 miles per gallon with them. You know, so it's going to cost you a lot less for gas with one of the hybrids and even less if you get the Prime.
Yeah, and, you know, most of the time you're just cruising around town, doing your errands, maybe heading to where 40, was it 40 miles now? What's the...
Yeah.
It's 40.
Last time I had the Prime, I ran it on my test loop and got almost 43 miles on it last time.
Yeah, 42 miles according to the EPA, so 43. Yeah, so it's even in, you know, it's the real world too. It's, you're getting over 40 miles. Man, just get that. You're not doing adventure stuff in a RAV4.
Yeah.
There's two types of adventure. There's people who are like, oh, you know what? I have a lot of snow. I have like real like off dirt roads I have to deal with. But those are Subaru owners. They're like the sort of like, okay, I really like logical. And then there's, I'm going to go do all these crazy things, and they never do. And those are Bronco and Jeep owners.
Yeah.
And they're, of course, and if you were one of those Bronco or Jeep owners who actually who actually goes off road and does it, you know, I applaud you because you are the reason those cars are built. But if you're, you know, whatever. I mean, I never take my BRZ to a track.
Yeah. So that's the RAV4. Get the basic one. Don't get the adventure, or step up. You know, and if you're gonna spend that money, get the Prime instead.
Yeah, throw a battery in there. Yeah. RAV4, better with a battery. That
should be the tagline.
Toyota, RAV4, better with a battery.
Yeah.
Save big money when you start your next project today at Menards. Convert your current recessed lighting with energy-saving LED downlights from Fight Electric. They're bright and install easily in just minutes. They also go from regular lighting to nightlight mode with just a simple flip of a switch. Save big on all Fight lighting products now at Menards. Shop our lighting options today in-store and on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. All right. This week, I also had the opportunity to meet up with a friend that owns a Tesla Model 3. And until about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, Tesla was requiring owners that wanted to get into the full self-driving beta program to get a score. They have a safety score that the car calculates based on your driving patterns, based on how hard you accelerate and brake and things like that. And in order to get into the beta program, you had to have a score of at least, I think it was 97 or 98 out of 100. And this owner was not quite there. Let's put it that way. Let's leave it at that. But a couple of weeks ago, they decided, well, you know what? We got to book some extra revenue by the end of the quarter. And so we're going to make FSD beta available to all the people who paid us $15,000 or somewhere between $5,000 and $15,000 over the last 5 years in order to get this so we can book that revenue and, you know, get some profits this quarter because we might not get it otherwise. And so no matter what your safety score is, you can now get the FSD beta. And so I reached out to my friend and said, hey, love to give this a shot. You know, I've never had an opportunity to
give it a roll.
Try this out. They said, yeah, come on over. And so we went for a drive. Let's just say my previous suspicions from watching videos of other people with FSD beta is that this software should not be on public streets in the hands of consumers. It does basic things like keeping the car centered in the lane and even doing lane changes. Does that just fine, you know? But I mean, autopilot has done that fine for years.
Yeah,
and other systems like Super Cruise do it fine.
Four, five, 6 years.
It's been over 6 years since they announced FSD.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It was October 2016 when they announced it. And at that time, you know, I'll include a link to that conference call, but basically the first sentence out of Musk's mouth on that conference call is, every Tesla we're building now, this was in October 2016, he said, every Tesla we're building now has everything we need for full level 5 autonomy, and all we have to do is update the software. And level 5 means that it can operate without supervision, without anybody in the vehicle, without intervention, under all conditions.
I was at that event. It was like me and like just like maybe 8 other people, and he just sort of appeared out of a side room, sort of disheveled. And I was like,
also his normal look.
Yeah, yeah. You're like, huh? This is kind of a big deal. And he just sort of like appeared and then disappeared back into a side door, and I'm like, all right. And then they let us drive the car.
So, it's not capable of self-driving. It's, you know, it's a decent driver assist system, but there are still way too many scenarios where it just has no idea what to do, you know, with, and this, you know, often includes, you know, you go to different cities, different regions, and you'll find different road configurations. You know, some places you'll find more roundabouts, other places, you have different kinds of stuff, different ways that they set up the roads and the rules of the road. And here in Michigan, we have a phenomenon known as the Michigan left turn. And so on some major thoroughfares like Woodward Avenue and Telegraph Road in the Detroit area, or Jackson Road in Ann Arbor, these are wide roads, typically, you know, three lanes in each direction with a center median. And in order to improve traffic flow and safety, instead of allowing left turns off of these roads, you know, at various intersections, direct left turns, what they force you to do is kind of drive just past the road that you want to turn on, and there will be a cutout in that center median, so basically another left turn lane where you can do a U-turn. And so typically, you know, you would go, you know, 50 or 100 yards past the intersection, go into this left turn lane, do a U-turn, come back and make a right turn onto that road instead of doing a left. And when we tried this on Woodward Avenue at several locations, the car would get over to the main left lane, slow down as it approached this turn lane, and then it's like it had, I don't know what to do with this, and so it would speed up and go on to the next one. And it would, aww, and then would come up on another one, you know, another quarter mile or half a mile down the road. It's like, I don't know what to do with this. And it would just keep going until it finally got to a spot where there was just a normal place where it would make a normal left turn. And then it made the left turn, looped through a neighborhood, and finally came back to Woodward Avenue. And this is just one of the things. Another thing that I didn't see, but that the owner told me about was, he was in downtown Detroit near Huntington Place Convention Center. And on Jefferson Avenue, this is the facility formerly known as Cobo Center. And if you're heading west on Jefferson towards the Convention Center, as you approach the Convention Center, about a block away, the road actually splits. And the two, so it's four lanes, the two right lanes, or sorry, it's three lanes. The center lane splits. The right lanes go straight ahead until you get to the Convention Center. Then you have to turn right onto Washington Avenue. The lanes on the left go down through a tunnel underneath the Convention Center and come up on the Lodge Freeway. And he said that the first time he tried it, he was in the center lane approaching this, and it went to the right. And it thought it was, you know, I guess it thought it was going through the tunnel and just went straight and didn't even start to slow down as it was actually approaching the building, approaching the Convention Center. He had to intervene and hit the brakes.
All right. I know exactly where that's at. That took me a second to like figure to my brain. Yeah. You just like slam right straight into the Convention Center.
Yeah. The next time. Yeah. It's like it was trying to emulate back in the early 90s when they launched the original Jeep Grand Cherokee. And drove it through the glass doors of the Convention Center. You know, it's like it wanted to drive up the, the steps through the glass doors. The next time, so from there, he looped back around, tried it again. The next time, it went left. You know, it was in the same lane. He went left and went down through the tunnel. And then he looped it again, came back around again. The third time, it did the first thing. It went to the right again. So one of the fundamental problems with a system, or one of the fundamental things you have to do with a system like this, or any driver assist system, and I learned this back in the early 90s when I was working on ABS. One of, you know, my boss at the time, we were evaluating a system I was working on, and you know, so the thing you really have to do with any system like this is, whether it's behaving perfectly or not, what's more important is that it behaves consistently. It's got to be predictable for the driver.
Yeah.
So no matter what, you know, you get into any given situation, the driver has to know how the system's going to respond. And, you know, in this case here, it was unpredictable. And there were a lot of scenarios where it was very unpredictable, where sometimes it would work, sometimes it wouldn't. And it's just not ready to be used by the public. You know, they need to stop this beta testing with the public. This is not the way to do it, because it's dangerous. In fact, so much so that the owner of the car, after a couple of days, he went out and got a student driver sticker and put it on the back of on the trunk lid, because you know, it was so, you know, it did a lot of things like, you know, like a 16-year-old, you know, just learning how to drive would do, you know, randomly hitting the brakes and doing all kinds of other things.
Yeah.
And rather than get rear-ended, you know, he wanted to provide a warning to anybody following him that, hey, this car might do something weird. So he put a student driver sticker on there.
It's I've been in Teslas, and, you know, at the time, this is like 3-4 years ago, it was the best ADAS system on the road, but also the one with the most, where I was most likely to have something weird happen. Like, almost every Tesla I've ever been in, something just weird happens when ADAS is in, when the driver's assistance system is on. Like, it's just phantom braking, like, just weirdness, like, just weird thing. And that's what happens when you kind of turn everything up to 11, which is what Tesla essentially did when they first launched Autopilot. They just took a system and they just turned it all the way up. Yeah. And so we're like, hey, look what we've done. And you know, all the other automakers are like, you just turned up the Bosch system to 11. You didn't really do anything. You just, like, sort of removed some of the, you know, it's yeah. So, you know, now they have their own system, and they continually, you know, removing sensors in order to save money. And that's really the reason why you're doing it, is, you know, you're trying to get as much profit out of every vehicle as possible. And that's the thing. And you know, they've come up with this idea where if they put all the hardware on every Tesla and then they just hope that you turn it on and you pay for it, you know, that's sort of the, and that helps, that, you know, it reduces complexity in manufacturing, which, especially when they were brand new, you know, you don't want like 5 different types of Model 3 going down the line. If you got 2 types of Model 3, they all have all the hardware, and one has one battery pack and the other has another, that, you know, that's that, you know, but you can sell it as 5 different models or whatever. That's, you know, that's going to save you money, but you're also losing money if people aren't turning those, you know, aren't turning on the software packages that you're selling. And I think at some point they're like, well, we're not selling enough of these FSDs. So they just kept raising the price to like, was it $15,000 now?
Yeah, it's 15 grand now.
$15,000. You could buy a nice used car for $15,000.
Or you can subscribe for $200 a month.
Or you can, $200 a month is a lot of money. Mm-hmm. That's
more than a lot of people can afford for a car payment.
Yeah. And so, you know, you're paying a lot of money for a system on a car where they just keep pulling sensors off. And you're just like, well, I understand financially why they're doing this, but, you know, like you said, consistency. One of the things about when you ride a motorcycle, you want people to do the thing that you think they're going to do. And sometimes people will see someone ride a motorcycle and they'll try to be helpful in some way. Don't. Just do what you were going to do. If it's your turn at the light, go. If it's your turn at the stop sign, go. Don't try to, like, oh, well, let me just let you go. Because it's the motorcyclists do not like that. I had a friend, he would just turn his motorcycle off if the person refused to go.
Yeah.
When it was their turn. He's like, because when you introduce like these inconsistencies on the road or, you know, behind the wheel, like it just makes things really complicated. Just do the thing you're supposed to do when you're behind the wheel, and the car should just do the thing that everyone expects it to do when it's driving. And when it's like sort of all over the place, you can't trust it. And, you know, I talked to a guy on the plane coming back from, I don't know, wherever, some country. And he has a Model S, and he has a Plaid, and he's like the driver assistance is not great, and his wife refuses. She won't even turn it on. She absolutely hates that car just because of that, because he's like, it's all over the place. He's like, spent all this money on this system that doesn't really work that great.
Yeah.
And so, you know, outside of, you know, there, you know, I'm sure there's people who use it and they absolutely love it and they're like, it's the best thing ever. But a lot of the people who are on Twitter who would use it and love it, either A, are sycophants, or B, they have a vested interest in Tesla, which is, means they have a lot of money invested in Tesla, which, you know, if you put a lot of money into a company, you want that company to do well. And if you can, you know, argue that that company should be, you know, is doing well on Twitter, then you might as well.
Yeah. You know, and to be fair, you know, Tesla is not the only one of late, you know, that has had challenges with some of this inconsistent behavior. I mean, I've complained about Ford's Blue Cruise, you know, and the biggest complaint I have with Blue Cruise, well, one of the major complaints I have with Blue Cruise is also inconsistent behavior. You know, you're driving down a highway and, you know, you're approaching a curve. And this is one that hopefully the new update of Blue Cruise will address. But, you know, as you approach a curve in many, many instances, it'll tell you to put your hands back on the wheel. Because it doesn't, so far at least, it hasn't had predictive speed control where it uses the map to judge the radius of that curve and slow the truck down as you approach that curve, you know, and then speed back up the way GM's Super Cruise does.
Yeah.
Blue Cruise didn't do that. And so you're constantly having to, you know, be wary of when, you know, when you have to put your hands back on the wheel and retake control. And especially with, you know, a less than ideal user interface for it in terms of knowing, you know, when you need to take control. That inconsistency is one of my big complaints with it. That, yeah. You know, and speaking of the interface, that's another problem with the Tesla, especially in the Model 3 and the Model Y. Less so in the S and X, because they actually have an instrument cluster in front of the driveway, in front of the driver where it belongs. You know, on the S and the X, you just have some small icon, or on the Y and the 3, you just have some small icons in the upper left-hand corner of the center screen. And, you know, to let you know when it's engaged or when you need to take control back, you know. And given that they tell you that you have to keep your hands on the wheel and eyes on the road when you're using the system, you know, the fact that you have to look over away from the road, over and down at the screen to see, you know, what mode it's in and, you know, whether you need to, you know, be in full control or just let it do its thing. I think is also a bad user interface design. And I would have less of an issue with Tesla using just the center screen if they would at least offer a heads-up display, you know, so you could put that information in the heads-up display. But they don't even offer a heads-up display on any of their models, which I think is also problematic.
Yeah, it's mode confusion, which if you don't know what mode you're in, you're just driving and you're like, oh, the car's going to slow down, and then it doesn't.
Right.
Because you don't know what mode you're in. Now, that's a huge – I mean, that's why I remember when they showed off the Cadillac with Super Cruise the first time, it had those little lights on the steering – the little light mm-hmm. at the top of the steering wheel. And everyone was like, oh, my God, this is the dumbest thing I've ever seen. And then I drove it like however many months later. I was like, oh, this is awesome. This is the greatest thing I've ever seen.
You know exactly what mode it's in. If it's green, you're good to go, hands-free. If it's red – you got to put your hands on the wheel, and blue, it's ready to go whenever you want to take your hands off.
Yeah, it's. I mean, this whole thing is like super difficult, and I think everyone thought it was going to be a lot easier than it was. And like, we're 90% there, and they're like, yeah, but that last 10% is, you know, I'm 90% there to being a good guitarist because I know how to tune a guitar. I'm not a good guitarist. That last 10% is. That's to be the Eddie Van Halen of guitar. That's you know, decades and decades of work.
Yep. All right. Next up, GM this week made an announcement about their dealer community charging program. They actually first announced this last year, and it's a program where they're encouraging their dealers to sign up, especially dealers in rural areas, you know, away from major cities, where there typically isn't a lot of public charging infrastructure. And what GM is doing is, for dealers that sign up, they will supply them with up to 10 19-kilowatt level 2 chargers that can be installed around the community. So it's not for chargers at the dealerships, but to put them in other locations around the community. And so the dealers work with site owners, and GM participates in this as well. And GM provides the chargers. And then, you know, depending on where you are, you know, in some cases, you know, in partnership with the site owners and the dealers, sometimes the charging will be free. Sometimes they may charge for it. There's still, you know, that will vary depending on the location, just as it does for a lot of other level 2 public charging, a lot of the charge point chargers, Blink, and so on. Sometimes it's free. Sometimes you got to have to pay a fee. And they've got the first of those installed now. The first ones were with a dealer in central Wisconsin, northwest of Madison. They've put some chargers in there, some 19-kilowatt chargers. And, you know, so 19 kilowatts is pretty fast. You know, something like a Chevy Bolt, you know, you can charge it up in about 4 hours, three and a half, four hours at a 19 kilowatt charger. Like I said, GM will provide up to 10 chargers, and over 1,000 of their dealers, of their 4,000 dealers, have signed up for this program. They also have some installed in a town called Owosso near Flint, and there's a lot more coming over the next several months. So that's their dealer community charging program.
I mean, it's going to help the dealers sell the cars, because mm-hmm. you know, the infrastructure is the big, you know, and I know we always talk about, you know, range anxiety. It's really charging anxiety. People are just like, what do I charge? What do I, you know? You know, 19 kilowatts, that's
pretty fast for an AC.
It's pretty quick. Yeah, you throw that at, you know, and there are, when I was in the early days of EVs, back when I was reviewing them in San Francisco, where there's like zero chargers, like I was like, well, I guess I'm just going to go do some shopping at Walgreens, because that was the only place I could get a charging station. And so what happens is, you're driving around, you're like, oh, you know, I need to charge my car. Oh, this supermarket has a charger and this one doesn't. Well, why don't I just go to this supermarket? Because, like, you know, I can charge while I'm buying, you know, my groceries for the week. And, you know, this mall has charging, but this mall doesn't. And malls are essentially the same. You either want, you know, whatever pretzel, you know, both the pretzel places and, you know, it was Aunt Annie's.
Get your pretzels and your Cinnabons and your...
Yeah, your Wetzel's pretzels, your Aunt Annie's, they're essentially the same pretzel. Yeah. And so it doesn't matter what mall you go to. But no, I mean, this helps, and it gives the dealership gets, you know, to feel warm and cuddly for helping their community. The people who are looking for EVs feel better because they can see chargers out in their community. And of course, GM gets to put out this press release. But, you know, I went to Norway a few years ago to drive the some Mercedes SUV that was supposed to come here, the EV,
EQC.
EQC that never ended up not coming here. But just driving around Norway, you're like, there's chargers they're all along the street, they're just everywhere. And I'm like, this is kind of what everything needs to be. Because mm-hmm. you're just like, oh, you just pull up at a spot and you just plug in your charger and you go on your way. I think we're going to see a lot more of that sort of, hopefully, especially in cities and stuff. But like out in the middle of nowhere, again, I think I was talking to you before a podcast. There's like 3 EA stations within 5 miles of my house. I live in Northern California. It's fine. We're fine. I have to go check to see the EVgo station. They put in some new ones that's between me and one of the EA stations. That's 2 miles from my house. So a mile away is an EVgo, and then an extra mile is like an EA station. So I'm doing okay. But meanwhile, in other parts of the country, not so much. And so this really helps.
Well, my local EA station down the street here, they just finished installing brand new chargers there. They ripped out the old ones that were so problematic. And 5 of the 6 chargers, they left the one that had a CHAdeMO connector on it. But the other 5 chargers have all been replaced with brand fancy new chargers But they haven't been turned on yet. So hopefully next time I have a plug-in, an EV to charge, to drive, then those things will be turned on and I can go see if they actually work.
Cool. Yeah, the ones near my house are relatively new, so they haven't. I keep looking because I want to see the new chargers. I think I saw. I think I saw somewhere they were like working on them, but yeah, near my house. Let's see. There's one there. There's one there. There's one there. There's one there. I just pulled up a map. I mean, they're not everywhere. There's within, I don't know, like a 30-mile radius is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Are there any on the other side of the bridge? Yeah, there's like 7 EAs. Oh, well, 8, actually. There's 8 EA chargers near my house, so I'm okay. And that's not counting EVgo and then, of course, ChargePoint, which is usually a little bit lower, but they've been putting out high-speed DC fast chargers, too. So
yeah, well, the it's gas getting there. Right here that just put in a couple of DC ChargePoint DC chargers this summer.
Oh, cool.
Used one of those. Yeah. They're only 150 kilowatt, but that's, you know, that's fine still, for most people.
Yeah. So there was a Valero up the street from my house that I would walk to every day, and I became friends with the lady, especially during COVID, because it was, you know, like, I'm just going to walk to the store. They shut down to become a 7-Eleven, and everything in there was 7-Eleven branded. It just wasn't 7-Eleven brand. So like, oh, they're going to they're like, oh, we're remodeling the store. And I'm like, well, how long is that going to take? And they're like, a year. And I'm like, a year. And then they just demolished the store and then rebuilt another building like 30 feet over. But I keep driving by, they have a fence around it, and I'm kind of hoping, cause it's a gas station, I'm kind of hoping that they also put a charging station. I mean, I have charging at home. But, you know, every time I see something new, especially with gasoline, I'm like, just throw some charging in there, put coffee machine in.
I'm actually surprised. There's a brand new gas station that just opened up a couple months ago nearby here, where there used to be a gas station that closed like 10, 15 years ago, mm-hmm. and they demolished it and tore out the old tanks. And they just built a brand new gas station there, and I'm really surprised. And with a convenience, nice convenience store and everything. I'm surprised they didn't put any chargers in there.
It's, you know, throw some chargers in, put a little tables outside, and you're going to have people just hanging out at your gas station buying a lot more stuff, which is how you're making money anyway.
At least in the warm weather months. I don't think people are going to hang out at those tables in the wintertime here.
Yeah, I live in California. Well, it's like 30-something degrees outside, but we don't care. We're just like, oh, whatever.
All right. Are you excited for an Apple Car? Are you planning to get an Apple Car?
So, the Apple Car. I used to be the online editor, so I ran the website for all the news for a Mac site, for Mac Life, which used to be Mac Attic as part of the Future Publishing. I didn't start my technology, my journalism career, but, you know, a big part of my journalism career was in tech. And a big part of that was covering Apple. After that, I covered Apple for like Gizmodo, and I covered Apple for Wired. I covered Apple for Engadget. I've covered Apple for a long time. And this damn Apple Car has been around like almost the entire time. It's either the rumors or just like wishes. And I even wrote an article at Engadget. I'm like, you know, if Apple wants to do a car, they can. They, you know, they have the money. They have, you know. But what they want to do, you know, just make an autonomous car. Like, why? Who cares? Just a pure, like, level 5 autonomous car for someone to buy. No one's going to buy that because you can just have a taxi come to your house. B, if they do make one that is a taxi, you know, I was talking to the CTO of Mercedes, and I asked about taxis. He's like, are you going to wait 5 minutes longer for a Mercedes-branded taxi? No. He's like, why would you do that? He's like, there's no reason for that. And plus, they sell, most of Europe is littered with Mercedes brand, you know, Mercedes taxis. So I don't know. If they could just make a car, I mean, you know, it says they're pulling back on they're making it level 5, which means it has no wheels. It has, you know, not no wheel. It doesn't have
no
a steering wheel
or pedals.
No steering wheel or pedal. They're, you know, level 4, which is steering wheel and pedal, and then, you know, autonomous whenever you want it. And then level 3 obviously is you know, autonomous in very select areas, like which is what Mercedes is trying to launch right now. But sure.
You know, back in 2015 when it first, you know, the news about Project Titan, which is Apple's car program, first leaked out, I wrote a series of articles, you know, on my personal blog back at the time, and I'll include a link to that. you know, on why I didn't think that Apple would ever actually build a car. You know, first off, you know, the profit margins in the auto industry are peanuts.
They're
compared
super
to what Apple likes.
Slim. Like, Apple makes bazillions of dollars.
Apple's a company that likes, you know, 35 to 40% profit margins. Exactly. Nobody in the auto industry makes 35 to 40% profit margins. And then, you know, you also have the problem of how do you actually sell them? You know, Apple's not a company that is likely to embrace franchise dealers.
No.
Then, you know, you have challenges with the direct-to-consumer model like Tesla and Rivian and others do, you know, because you still have to have some service locations and, you know, you have somewhere to deliver the cars. And, you know, it would also limit where they could do it if they wanted to do direct-to-consumer. And I actually did speculate that, you know, if they were going to do something, that the way for them to do it would be to do a premium robo-taxi service. Because the other thing that Apple doesn't like is they don't like people messing with their stuff. They don't like them modifying their stuff. Even if you buy it, you know, if you buy an iPhone, you buy a Mac, you know, Apple does not like you making modifications to that stuff. And so what they, you know, what I speculated that they would probably do is do, a robo-taxi that they retain ownership of. That way, they don't have to mess with dealers. They don't have to, mess with distribution. They can limit where they're deployed to markets where there is a significant affluent, you know, consumer audience would be willing to pay a premium price for that, and you know, maybe do it as a subscription instead. You know, so you could get rides anytime you need, things like that, and you know, they retain control. You know, and it never gets modified. They have struggled apparently to develop an automated driving system. I mean, as much as I don't like the driver intervention data that California requires autonomous companies to submit every year, you know, if you look at that data from Apple versus everyone else, their numbers are pretty bad in terms of, you know, number of miles between interventions. Apple's got a lot of interesting technology that could benefit them in developing automated systems. You know, their Apple Silicon chips are incredibly powerful. You know, it would be, you know, a great platform for them to use. You know, they've done a lot of interesting stuff with sensors, but you know, now the latest report out of Bloomberg is that the whole program has been pushed back to at least 2026, and they've largely given up on the idea of doing a robo-taxi or a completely self-driving vehicle. And, you know, it's going to be a more conventional electric vehicle with a price starting at a minimum of $100,000.
Which we have enough $100,000 EVs, yeah, to be honest. I mean, I understand. I mean, if the goal is the sort of Tesla model, or really even the Mercedes model, which is like you put all the tech in the most expensive vehicle and then you wait for it to work its way down you keep introducing cheaper and cheaper models with the tech that you showed off 3 years ago in a more expensive model. That's great. And if Apple can do that, if Apple can come out in by 2030 with a $25,000 EV, awesome. That's great. Good. You know, I'll be very happy. But it's, yeah, like you said, like the profit margins are sort of like not great. It's becoming an increasingly crowded market. I mean, Tesla's feeling the squeeze. You just look at their China, what they're doing in China, and, you know, even here, and their stocks are kind of being punished for that. And so it's a sort of a thing. They have just momentum, I think. I think it's just inertia within Apple that we're going to do this thing. And like, there's been 50 executives that have worked on it over the years, like automotive executives that have sort of come and gone. And I think they show up and they're like, oh, we're going to do this great thing. I'm working with Apple. And then they're like, we would have already shown this off at the auto show if I had been working at GM or Toyota or whatever. So
I think if Apple really wants to do this, what they should do is just buy Lucid.
That's
they already have a factory, they're up and running, they've got product, really good product. Yeah. Just buy Lucid, you know, and that's the kind of product that would fit within the Apple ecosystem.
Yeah, and it's full of Apple employees.
Yeah.
They're, you know, the CTO, or not the main, like, engineer of, like, the software is, like, a bunch of Apple employees when they did the recent upgrade.
Yeah, Mike Bell.
Yeah, Mike Bell, super nice guy. You know, big nerd, so we hit it off great. but you know, he's just like, you know, I worked at Apple. We know how to ship software, and that's Apple. You know, software is, you know, that's what's having problems. You know, Volkswagen has problems with software. Everyone has problems with software. Lucid had problems with software, and then they got Mike Bell in there and a bunch of ex-Apple employees, and then they rewrote the code. So, yeah, no, it, you know, if buy something, maybe implement some of your stuff into it. And then hopefully, you know, bring the price down to, I mean, really, I mean, again, we have enough expensive EVs. I mean, I like driving them, but the rest of us need electric cars.
Yeah. Speaking of which, IHS, the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, they do a lot of crash testing of vehicles. They have their own crash test facility. And they do the top safety picks every year. They were a little concerned as to whether their crash test facilities would hold up with some of the very heavy new EVs that are coming to market. And they specifically were wondering, you know, could this facility withstand a 9,500-pound EV? Gee, who makes a 9,500-pound EV? Oh, yeah, GM, the Hummer EV.
Listen, it's a moonshot. They got a lot of moon, like, iconography inside the car. It's really to be driven on the moon, where it's only like 6,500 pounds.
Yeah. So they took an old F-150 and they loaded it up with concrete blocks and steel plates, you know, to bring it up to 9,500 pounds. And they did a crash test with it to see if they're, you know, because the way the crash test facilities work, they basically have a cable buried in the floor. And they hook it up to the bottom of the vehicle, and they accelerate it down, you know, down a long runway to get it up to the test speed, and then let it go as it hits the just as it hits the barrier, and so they accelerated it up to 40 miles an hour. Fortunately, it had no problem at all handling a 9,500-pound F-150, which is about twice its normal weight, so they're. They're looking forward to finally testing some of these big EVs in the not too distant future.
Yeah, no, it'll. They're heavy.
Yeah,
that's the, you know, and so, you know, it's, you know, we're trading one issue for another, and you know, and you know, people are like, oh well, they're, you know, they're heavy and they're bad on the roads. I'm like, well, yeah, so are big trucks and other things that are on the roads, and so there's, I don't know.
I saw a Carrier the other day with a couple of Hummers on it, and you know, those things are so heavy that they only carry two at a time.
they're heavy. It's a Hummer. Mm-hmm. I know we can sit there and make fun of it being like just how, you know, ridiculous. But you know what? It's always been ridiculous. It's, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger wanted a Hummer. One day, and that's where this all started. It's all Arnold's fault. He was a big environmentalist, and you know, he was like he was a Republican governor of California, but the Republican governor of California is essentially like a Democrat everywhere else in the country. So, yeah, but yeah, no, it's go watch the sort of the video of this car, because it's just like all the, it just shows you just like all the insanity of the weight as it just sort of flies through the. The captain, yeah. And it's, you know, this is not indicative of what happened with an EV because the batteries are at the bottom, blah blah blah. But still, I don't know. It's just sort of, you know, crash videos and crash are the funnest things ever to watch.
Yeah, there's some wild ones out there. One of my favorite ones was I don't know, about 10-15 years ago, Mercedes did a two car crash test with an E class. And a Smart, and you know, did a small offset head-on crash test with a Smart and an E-Class, and you know, because they're wondering, you know, how do these two very different cars interact with each other, And turned out that the, you know, even though the Smart, you know, doesn't have much in the way of crush zones, it's so small and light that it basically just bounces off the E-Class and goes flying off to the side.
There was a video of a ramming a Smart 70 miles an hour into a concrete barrier.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards, like, you could still open and close the doors. Like, that's how, like, it'll sort of, like, I remember people like, oh, they're not very safe. I'm like, I want you to go watch this video. Because that's the engineering that went into that little thing. I mean, but it's, you know, it doesn't help you when you're driving around in a Smart and everyone's driving around in Tahoes.
Yeah. All right. Finally, Polestar and Mercedes in the last couple of weeks have both announced power-up options for their EVs, where you can pay a little extra money and get some extra performance. A few weeks back, I talked about the Polestar 2 Performance that I was driving, which had an extra 68 horsepower compared to the standard dual-motor Polestar. Well, now, if you buy the standard dual-motor Polestar, you can get that extra 68 horsepower for, I believe it's about $1,600.
$1,200.
Okay. Yeah. So $1,200 and yeah, $1,195. So, fortunately, in the case of Polestar, it's a one-time payment. You pay the $1,200, you get the extra 68 horsepower. Mercedes is doing it a little bit differently. They're making it an annual fee to get the extra power on the EQS and the EQE, I think. And I think it's about I think they're the ones that were charging $1,600 a year. So you get an extra 100 horsepower, but you have to keep paying for it in perpetuity.
Yeah, I think, I don't know why Mercedes is doing this, because, I mean, we all, like, just hammered on BMW for years about CarPlay. And that was way less expensive. Just because you could get a Hyundai with CarPlay for, you know, as like either as an option and now a standard. But you only paid for it once. You pay for it once and then you move on. And Mercedes is like, oh, everyone will be fine with this. But they're not. They're not fine with it. Just set it as a one-time fee. As a one-time fee, everyone's like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah, I can totally, you know, if someone's, oh, I want 68 more horsepower in my Polestar 2, would you have $200? You know what? Fine. I'll do it. You know, it's like putting mufflers and a header on your old car. You probably paid, you know, you probably pay that much, you know, $600 for the extra 3 horsepower back in the day. But they're like, oh, well, you know, if you just pay a couple $100 a month. No. Because we're already, it's like death by 1,000 subscriptions at some point. You know, we're subscribed to so many things. And, you know, Care by Volvo, I think, is really smart. It's a subscription service, but you get in the whole car. It's not, yeah. The subscription stuff for some of the car stuff, I understand. Like if FSD, when that works, or Super Cruise, if you don't want to have it all the time, you want to pay like, you know, $50 because that month your family's going on a long road trip. Great. I can understand that. But just for power, just no, because no one's paying for power like for a month and then like, hey, look what I can do. And then,
yeah. Yeah, so Mercedes is also charging $1,200, but it's an annual subscription. And on the EQE 350, it raises the power from 215 to 260 kilowatts. So you get an extra 45 kilowatts, so about 60 horsepower. So it's about the same increase as you get with the Polestar, but you have to pay it every year that you want to keep it.
Every
you
stop year, paying, not just once.
You go back to being just a little bit slower.
But then it
takes you an extra second to get to 60 miles an hour.
But then, of course, you have to understand, is this linked to the car or is it linked to the owner? If I sell this car later...
I would guess it's almost certainly linked to the owner.
So when you go... This happened with, like, Model S's. When people are selling them on the, you know, used Model S's, people would buy them. They were selling them as, oh, it has... you know, autopilot, which at the time was still an option. And then, you know, you sold it as one of the options, autopilot, and then people would buy it, and then Tesla would retroactively turn off autopilot. Like, hey, I paid for autopilot for this car, which is just like, okay, so now now you're making the owner who's trying to sell the car determine whether or not the things that he or she has already paid for are are going to go with the car. And then the people who are buying the car, they have to figure out, like, well, if I buy this with this extra power, am I keeping the extra power or am I going to lose the extra power? It's, yeah, it becomes this whole, like, really confusing thing. I really think it should just be linked to the vehicles. But that's my, you know, that's just for the sake of ease, of, yeah, of confusion.
But then
the
you, don't make
confusion.
It, you don't make as much profit then.
Yeah, you can't double up on it. Yeah. But then you have people like having to deal with, you know, it's a whole.
All right, let's answer a couple of questions. First up from Mark Shakespeare. Stellantis dealers in every city here in Northwest Arkansas, Jeeps, Rams, Dodges, Chrysler, and even one Fiat dealer, but no Alfa Romeo dealer within 250 miles. In this situation, owning a new Giulia with a warranty seems to be pointless, so I've been considering a well-optioned, pre-loved 2019-2020 2-liter turbo Giulia. I note a little warranty left and relying on finding a good independent mechanic, though so far not found a shop that mentions specializing in modern Alphas. Is owning a Giulia so far away from a trained Alfa mechanic asking for trouble? I wrote the same kind of question on a popular Giulia forum, and even there they said I would need to be close to a solid dealer. Everyone says the Giulia is a great driver's car, and it seems a favorite with the journalist, even though it's not a wagon. Look forward to hearing words of wisdom from the Wheel Bearings car therapy team.
I love the Giulia.
Yeah, me too.
I love that car so much. I would not buy it if I wasn't near a dealer. There are plenty of Giulias on the road that have had zero problems. But I know if I bought one and we're in Northwest Arkansas, I know within like 3 months something weird would happen, and then I'd have to like trailer it for 300 miles, you know, 6 hours away
He does mention that there is a Fiat dealer nearby.
I mean, you can reach out to the dealership and see if they have.
Yeah, that's what I would do is ask the Fiat dealer or ask the other Stellantis dealerships, you know, if they will do service on a Giulia. Certainly, they can definitely get parts for it. The challenge is whether their technicians have the training, you know, and are familiar with the car to do the diagnostics and to do the service on it. The Alfa dealer or the Fiat dealer is probably your best bet in this case to see if they're able to do it. If not, if they can't do service, just because the number of modern Alphas that have been sold is not huge. In the U.S., you know, in an area like this, you know, the number of them around, you know, the mechanics that
you're going to be a unicorn if you have one. You're going to be like one of like three people. And
yeah, I mean, the number of mechanics that are likely to know how to work on one are probably pretty slim. So I would probably avoid it unless you move somewhere else. All right. The other question we had this week was from Bryn Berenshausen. He says, "Hey guys, had a thought about plug-in hybrids. I owned a standard hybrid, Prius, and a BEV, a Model 3, and I can't say I'd actually want a plug-in hybrid. I get why on paper they seem like a good idea, but they're expensive, complicated, and don't get the real benefits of an EV because it's still the hybrid powertrain. Why has the standard for these been a tiny battery with a gas engine that powers the wheels instead of a full electric powertrain with a mid-sized battery and a gas motor that just acts as a generator? This would give the better driving experience and efficiency from the electric motors with the extended range from the gas without the complexity of the internal combustion engine and transmission. A bigger battery, say around 40 kilowatt hours, would make it a more appealing package, in my opinion. My commute is longer than most PHEVs range, and I'd still want more EV range for moderate road trips than these currently offer. I think BMW did this with the i3, train locomotives have done this, and it's the approach Edison Motors is taking for big rig trucks. Why hasn't it been tried for passenger cars?
Cost. Just to write down. You're throwing, like, yeah. That battery is so much more is going to make that V, because you're already talking about expensive. If you're throwing a 40 kilo, you're like, you're throwing like a lot more money at that car in order to get the hybrid system.
Yeah.
That's what you're talking about.
Yeah. Basically what Bryn's describing for the listeners is a series hybrid, which is, if you go back to 2007 when GM showed the original Chevy Volt concept, not the production version, but the concept, this is exactly what they described there. You know, small three-cylinder engine that would just drive a generator to keep the battery charged when it, once it got depleted. And then the battery and the electric motors would drive the wheels. And also the Fisker Karma, the original Fisker. And it's now sold as the Karma Rivero, and a couple of other variations of that. That is also the same kind of configuration where the engine is not mechanically connected to the drive wheels at all. It just turns a generator. It's in some ways it's more complicated. Trying to do a 40 kilowatt hour battery pack in most vehicles and have a small engine for a generator would probably be too much to package. Although I do expect that we are going to see something like this on the truck side, particularly with Stellantis, with the Ram pickup. They're going to show a concept version of this next month at CES. And last year when Stellantis had their EV day, they hinted at a range-extended version of the Ram EV. And I think we will see something like this on the truck side, having a small engine range extender to keep the battery charged once it gets depleted. But those are much larger vehicles. And, where that would be handy on something like the Ram is for towing, because this is the problem with towing is you lose so much range when you hook up a big trailer that having a range extender would be a huge benefit in that case. The BMW i3, they used a two-cylinder boxer motorcycle engine as their range extender for that one. And, once you got into extended range mode, it didn't have enough power. So you didn't have the full power of the vehicle available to you. So you
45 miles an hour.
Yeah. You had limited performance with that because the engine was so small, couldn't drive a big enough generator to actually be all that useful.
Yeah.
The reality is, maybe for you, Bryn, a plug-in hybrid doesn't make sense. But I think there's also a lot of people for whom it makes huge sense. I mean, if you, 75-80% of all daily driving is less than 40 miles. If you have a 40-mile electric range, 35 to 40-mile electric range, that hybrid is going to be, that plug-in hybrid's going to meet most of your driving needs just on pure electricity without ever using that engine. And some hybrids, are what we call through the road hybrids, where instead of the more complex, drive unit where the motors are integrated into the transmission, like the Toyota style hybrids, you have the Volvos, which have a through the road hybrid system. So it has just the conventional transmission and engine driving the front wheels and then an electric motor on the rear axle. And there's no mechanical connection between them. So when it's in electric mode, it's only driving off the rear axle, driving purely electrically. The engine's not doing anything at all. It's just along for the ride. In that case, the latest versions of those will do about 33 to 36 miles on a charge, which again, for most people is going to be sufficient to meet their daily driving needs. And you will very rarely ever turn on the engine.
Yeah, it's. I think people think they drive a lot further than they actually do, just because traffic. They're like, well, I spent an hour in traffic. I'm like, how far is your work really? Yeah. And they look it up online. They're like, oh my god, it's only 15 miles. We end up, a lot of us drive not nearly as far as we do during our daily drive. My brother has a Volt. He loves that thing, and he has a pretty far commute. Actually, I think he does 30 something. But, his drive there is electric. At work, he could charge it for a long time until they figured out they would. Mm-hmm. He was just plugging it into the wall at work, and you can't do that anymore. But I think there and, some of the way back, like it was electric, and then, you know, it was gas after that. And then COVID happened and he works from home. And at one point the car just told him, you need to use up all the gas because you haven't used the gas in your car, because he was just using it as they're just driving around town, like taking care of things. And so, cause he's not doing that long commute anymore, like he wasn't using the gas. The gas was going bad. So he had to actually use, you know, the car was like, I have to use up all this gas because it's going bad. And then you can use the electric car. So there are a lot of people. And I think people are still sort of afraid of electric cars for a lot of reasons. You know, I think we haven't, you know, as a society, we haven't done a pretty great job at explaining how they actually work and how everything works and charging at home, et cetera. And so when you have these, well, I can still charge, but I still have that gas, so I can still do that other thing. And Americans buy cars for edge cases. That's, yeah. What if I want to go on a drive? What if there's an emergency? What if, you know, if you live in Northern California, where there's a fire and I have to, you know, I have to evacuate, my electric car's not going to get me there. Whereas, you know, I have a plug-in hybrid. I know that every day I'm just using electric, but when something happens, I have that gas, you know, that tried and true decades, over 100-year-old gas engine. It's ready to rock. So I think there's maybe for most people, they're getting a plug-in hybrid, which they really could have just got an EV. But, you know, if it gets people into the getting used to plugging it in every night, and it gets people to understand that they're not driving nearly as far as they thought they were, if it's 40 miles and they realize they're never using gas, and they're like, oh, well, maybe my next car should be an EV, and this will be the car for road trips. And so logically, I can understand your, but no one buys cars based on logic, to be honest.
Yeah, unfortunately.
I mean, we wouldn't have Miatas and BRZs and if it was for logic, we'd all be driving Camrys.
Yeah, or RAV4s.
We'd all be driving RAV4 Primes.
Yeah. All right, well, that's it for this week. Next week, we will have Nicole back with us. Thanks, everybody, and we'll talk to you next time.
Bye.